Welcome to this teaching. Today we are taking a really close look at a deeply fascinating source.
Yes, we are.
It is a canonical text from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, specifically the Dzogchen Kangyur called the Srigupta Esautra.
And we are incredibly fortunate to be working with the beautiful English translation recently completed by the 84,000 Project.
We really are. And, you know, our mission for this session is to figure out how a perfectly awakened being handles a highly calculated assassination attempt.
Right. And perhaps more importantly, what the mechanics of that specific encounter can teach us about neutralizing the toxic traps in our own lives.
Exactly, because we are looking at a scenario here where a trap is meticulously laid, but the person walking into it possesses absolute, unobstructed omniscience.
He sees the hidden pit. He knows all about the poisoned food.
He knows it all, and yet he just walks right in.
It really is the ultimate subversion of worldly hostility. Because when perfect awareness meets profound malice, the result is not victimhood.
No, it's something entirely different.
It is an earth-shattering display of spiritual power. We really have a profound privilege to be exploring this Dharma teaching together today.
Absolutely. As practitioners, just taking the time to sit with these teachings is deeply grounding. And the lineage of this specific Esautra carries immense historical weight, doesn't it?
Oh, certainly. We're talking about a text that was translated into Tibetan back in the late 8th or early 9th century.
Wow, that long ago.
Yes, by the Indian preceptors Jinamitra and Dhanashila, who worked alongside the great Tibetan editor and translator, the monk Yeshe Day.
But its reach was truly Pan-Asian, right? I mean, it was translated into Chinese as early as 583 CE.
It was. And the famous pilgrim Sun Zhang actually recorded seeing a physical stupa in the ancient city of Rajagauta, marking the exact spot where the events we're about to discuss took place.
That historical continuity really grounds our discussion. It reminds us that for over a millennium, practitioners have turned to this teaching.
Right. And not merely as an entertaining narrative, though it is very dramatic. They turn to it as a highly sophisticated philosophical exploration.
It is essentially a masterclass in understanding karma, isn't it?
It is. It teaches the infallible nature of our past actions and the ultimate truth that a realized mind is structurally invulnerable to worldly harms.
And that is exactly how we're going to approach this today. We will systematically walk through the present-day narrative of this plot against the Buddha in Rajagauta.
And as we do, we will unpack the four past life stories, the Jatakas, that he shares along the way.
Throughout this exploration, we really invite you, the listener, to reflect on your own practice. We all face our own versions of fire and poison.
We do. And how we metabolize those forces is the very essence of the path.
So let us begin by setting the scene on Vulture Peak. The Esautra opens with the Blessed One dwelling there, surrounded by a massive, truly diverse assembly.
We have monks, nuns, lay devotees, kings, and even celestial beings, gods, nagas, yakshas.
It's a huge gathering, and the text emphasizes his immense veneration. He is receiving the highest provisions from all realms.
But then, the Esautra provides this beautiful anchoring statement. It says, "Just as water does not adhere to a lotus, desires do not sully the Blessed One."
The imagery of the lotus there is so powerful. It's our first critical thematic marker, isn't it?
It is, because it establishes the internal reality of the Buddha before we even encounter the external threat.
Right.
The lotus grows in the muck and mud of the swamp, you know. Yet its petals emerge utterly pristine.
So he's in the world, but not of it.
Exactly. The Buddha is operating deeply within the material world, interacting with kings and gods, receiving the highest honors Samsatra has to offer.
But his mind remains completely untethered.
Perfectly untethered. There's absolutely no clinging. And that lack of clinging is the foundation of his invulnerability.
We immediately contrast that pristine state with a householder named Srigupta. He lives down below in the bustling city of Rajagauta.
Yes, and the Esautra goes to great lengths to inventory Srigupta's vast wealth.
Oh, it really does. He possesses stores of grain, gems, pearls, lapis lazuli, fine gold, elephants, workers.
In the eyes of the world, he has made it. He is affluent, secure.
But spiritually, the text describes him as deeply impoverished. He is neither devout nor pious.
And he harbors a deep, active disdain for the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sunaga.
His spiritual allegiance belongs entirely to a Jain master named Natthiputra. Now, as we introduce this character, we should probably pause.
Right? We should. We need to note that we are reading a Buddhist text, and it is presenting a rival religious teacher.
So we have to read this impartially. We need to recognize that this ancient text is using Jataputra as a narrative antagonist to set up the philosophical stakes.
Right. It is not attempting to provide an objective historical record of Jain teachings. That is an essential contextual note.
Within the narrative framework of this S-Otra, Jataputra represents the absolute peak of worldly, cynical logic.
He is deeply threatened by the Buddha's growing renown. He summons Sugupta and just dismisses the Buddha as a mere novice renunciant.
Right. He says Gautama is deceiving the world with false claims of omniscience. And then he commands Sugupta to murder him.
He promises that successfully eliminating this rival will bring Sugupta immense fame and social standing.
The mechanics of the assassination plot are, well, they are fascinating because they weaponize the Buddha's own teachings against him.
They do. Yatiputra instructs Sugupta to dig a deep pit right at the main entrance of his house.
And he tells him to light a flameless, smokeless fire at the bottom and camouflage it with a thin, very deceptive cover.
Then inside the house, he is to prepare a feast laced with deadly poison.
Finally, Sugupta is to go and personally invite the Buddha to a midday meal. It's so meticulously evil.
It is. And the rationale behind this trap is a brilliant manifestation of dualistic thinking.
How so?
Well, Jataputra argues that if Gautama is truly omniscient, as he claims, he will foresee the trap and refuse the invitation.
Right. And in that scenario, Jataputra can publicly denounce him as a coward and a fraud.
Exactly, destroying his reputation. Conversely, if Gautama accepts the invitation, it proves he is not omniscient.
Because he will fall into the hidden fire pit and burn to death.
Or, if he somehow bypasses the pit, he will consume the poisoned food and die. In Jataputra's mind, all possible outcomes lead to the destruction of the Buddha.
It is a purely malicious catch-22. But wait, if the Buddha is fully omniscient, he sees the entire board.
He does.
He knows about the hidden pit of fire, and he knows about the poisoned food. Shurugupta approaches Vulture Peak, formally invites him to the meal, and the Buddha accepts through silence.
Yes, his silence is acceptance.
But why on earth would he go? I mean, if you know someone is acting in completely bad faith, actively trying to murder you, why not simply expose the plot from a safe distance?
It's a great question. Why validate the invitation of an assassin?
Exactly.
Well, that question cuts to the very heart of what an awakened being actually is.
Yeah.
To understand the Buddha's silence, because in this context, silence is an active, profound choice, we must look through the lens of bodhicitta.
Supreme compassion.
Yes. The Buddha does not operate on the level of ego defense. He has no reputation he feels the need to protect.
He doesn't care about winning a public debate against a rival.
Not at all. The text explicitly reveals his internal motivation. He looks at Sugupta and thinks, this man seeks to treat me like this because he has come under the influence of a wicked spiritual friend.
Oh, wow.
He continues, but he will soon turn to the pure topic set out in the Dharma.
So he doesn't see a murderer standing before him at all. He sees a victim of profound delusion who actually have the capacity to change.
Exactly. He sees the totality of Sugupta's karmic trajectory. Through his omniscience, the Buddha perceives that beneath this thick layer of hostility, Sugupta possesses the ultimate potential for awakening.
That is incredible.
The Buddha chooses to step directly into the physical trap because it is the exact necessary pedagogical intervention required to shatter Sugupta's delusion.
He is literally risking his physical form to save his would-be murderer's mind.
He is.
That dramatically reframes the entire narrative. The trap isn't Jataputra cornering the Buddha. It's the Buddha allowing the trap to be set so he can dismantle Sugupta's ego from the inside out.
And Sugupta, locked in his dualistic worldview, entirely misses this compassion.
Totally misses it. When the Buddha accepts in silence, Sugupta literally lifts his index finger in triumph.
He really thinks he has proven the Buddha is blind to his thoughts.
He rushes back down to Rajaga to finalize his deadly preparations. And this creates such a stunning juxtaposition.
It really does. Inside the city walls, you have Sugupta scurrying in the shadows, fueled by malice, hiding a pit of fire.
He even locks his own wife in a room because she recognizes the plot and tries to intervene.
Right. He's entirely consumed by the dense, heavy mechanics of deceit. Meanwhile, outside the city, the very fabric of the cosmos is responding to the Buddha's conscious decision.
The descent from Vulture Peak is described in breathtaking cinematic detail.
It's beautiful.
Before leaving, the Buddha instructs his attendant, Ananda, to ensure no monk enters the house before him. He is protecting the Sangha.
Yes. And then the procession begins. He is not walking alone.
No, he is flanked by the heaviest hitters of Buddhist cosmology. Brahma Sahampati, the deity who originally implored the Buddha to teach, walks on his right.
Shukra, the lord of the gods, walks on his left. The four great kings follow behind him, carrying his parasol.
And the heavens respond. A gentle rain falls to settle the dust. A cloud hovers to provide shade. And celestial beings shower the path with sandalwood powder and lotus blossoms.
We must understand that this cosmic procession is not mere decorative mythology.
Right, it's not just a fairy tale.
In the Buddhist worldview, the physical universe and the minds of sentient beings are not completely separate entities.
The environment is intimately responsive to the spiritual purity of enlightened consciousness.
Exactly. When a perfectly awakened mind, generating limitless bodhicitta, moves through space, it literally reorganizes the environment around it.
The presence of such profound merit exerts a palpable harmonizing force on reality itself.
And we see that harmonizing force manifests vividly the moment they reach the city limits.
The Esotra tells us that as the Buddha sets his golden-colored right foot upon the threshold of Arjaka, the earth quakes in six different ways.
It shifts, shudders, and trembles. But this is not a destructive seismic event. It is a joyous vibration.
What follows is a cascade of profound miracles. The blind can suddenly see, the deaf hear, and the insane recover their senses.
Prisoners find their bonds released. Bitter enemies look at each other and experience sudden fondness.
And crucially for the narrative, anyone in the city who had ingested poison is miraculously cured of its effects.
That detail is so important.
When encountering texts like this, you know, a listener might wonder how to parse these events. Are we meant to read these miracles as literal historical occurrences? Or are they elaborate metaphors?
Well, in the Mahayana tradition, that distinction between literal and metaphorical often collapses entirely.
How do you mean?
Traditional commentaries certainly accept these events as literal manifestations of a Buddha's limitless field of merit.
Because he has spent countless lifetimes perfecting generosity and ethics.
Right. The sheer energetic weight of their physical presence brings spontaneous healing. However, the pedagogical value of the Esotra lies in the psychological metaphor.
These miracles beautifully symbolize what occurs when the Dharma genuinely enters the space of an afflicted mind.
Precisely. The people of Rajaka being cured of physical poison foreshadows the central conflict.
Right. The Buddha is walking toward a feast laced with venom, but the narrative is establishing early on that his very nature neutralizes toxins.
Furthermore, the healing of the blind and deaf represents the lifting of fundamental ignorance.
And the sudden affection between enemies represents the pacification of deep-seated anger.
The physical miracles are outward, visible expressions of the internal liberation the Dharma provides. The environment is healing because the ultimate healer has arrived.
As this miraculous procession moves through the streets, the tension really heightens. The physical danger of the concealed fire pit is looming just ahead.
And suddenly, the procession is interrupted.
Yes, a lay devotee, recognizing the Buddha and knowing of Shugupta's plot, throws himself on the ground in terror.
He begs the Buddha to turn back, warning him that a hidden fire pit awaits. He is terrified that the eye of the world is about to be destroyed.
The Buddha's response to this terrified devotee contains the core philosophical thesis of the entire Esotra.
He speaks with absolute, unshakable calm.
He says, "Lay brother, fire could not physically affect me even when I was born as an animal, how much less so now that I am a completely awakened Buddha."
And then he delivers the key line. "I have extinguished the three fires of attachment, anger, and delusion, so there is no basis for fire to physically affect me."
No basis for fire to physically affect me. That phrasing is just so deliberate.
It is. He doesn't claim to have a magical shield or a spell of protection that repels the heat.
He is stating a structural reality about his own being. The very fuel that allows fire to cause harm simply does not exist within his continuum anymore.
I think we really need to spend some time unpacking this because it sounds like a riddle.
It does. How does extinguishing anger stop physical fire from burning your skin?
To grasp this, we must delve into the Buddhist concept of shunyata, or emptiness. The Esotra is proposing a radical understanding of reality here.
Because we tend to think of external elements like fire, water, or poison as inherently real, solid, independent things.
Yes, things that act upon us from the outside. But in Buddhist philosophy, external phenomena and internal mental states are deeply interdependent.
They aren't separate at all.
Exactly. Physical fire is fundamentally related to the internal fires of the afflictive emotions. Attachment, anger, and delusion. Let's use a biological analogy.
I think that would be helpful.
Think of how a virus infects a body. The virus can only cause harm if the host's cells have the specific receptors that allow the virus to bind to them.
Right. And if the receptors are absent, the virus just washes harmlessly through the system.
Precisely.
So the ego, the sense of a solid, independent self, acts as the receptor for worldly harm.
That is the exact mechanism. Our clinging, our anger, our deep-seated delusion that we are separate from the universe, these are the psychological receptors that allow external elements to cause suffering.
And because the Buddha has completely eradicated the illusion of a separate self.
Because his mind is entirely empty of attachment, anger, and delusion, the external element of fire can find no resonance.
It has no hook to latch onto.
He has removed the receptors, so the fire has no basis upon which to inflict harm.
To illustrate this profound concept, the Buddha doesn't just offer a theoretical explanation, he grounds it in a narrative.
He recounts a Jataka tale, a story from one of his countless past lives.
He tells the devotee about a time he was incarnated on the island of Bhagbhachepa as a tiny partridge chick.
Yes. His wings had not yet fully formed. He was completely vulnerable.
And a king, acting out of pure malice, sets a massive fire to the island, intending to slaughter all the wildlife.
The Esso Otra paints a picture of utter chaos. The forest is a raging inferno.
And the partridge chick's mother is driven by desperate, frantic instinct. She is flying to the water, dipping her feathers, and splashing tiny drops around her nest.
She is literally trying to hold back a firestorm with two drops.
The contrast drawn here is profoundly moving and deeply instructive.
The mother bird represents worldly effort driven by attachment and panic. Her actions, while born of love, are completely futile against the scale of the destruction.
The partridge chick, however, possesses a completely different orientation to reality.
Despite being physically helpless, his mind is perfectly still.
He tells his mother to cease her frantic splashing, recognizing the emptiness of her worldly efforts. He asks her to simply place him on a high branch and leave him.
And what the chick does next introduces another crucial mechanism in our understanding of Buddhist practice.
Sitting in the path of the inferno, the Parker's chick utters an act of truth.
He recites a verse acknowledging the helpless beings around him and asks that the noxious fire retreat.
Instantly, the massive forest fire dies down and moves away. The Buddha then tells the devotee, "I was that partridge chick. Fire could not harm me even then."
This concept of the act of truth, the Satyagrahi, is fascinating.
It really is. How should we understand this? Because on the surface, it sounds like he just cast a magic spell.
It is vital to distinguish the Satyagrahi from magical thinking. A spell implies manipulating external forces to get what you want.
Right.
An act of truth is entirely different. It relies on the sheer, undeniable force of absolute reality. Think of a tuning fork.
Okay, a tuning fork.
When you strike a perfectly calibrated tuning fork, its vibration is so pure and consistent that other objects in the room will begin to resonate at that exact frequency. The partridge chick is not trying to manipulate the fire. He aligns his mind, his intention, and his speech so perfectly with ultimate truth and pure compassion that his mind becomes that tuning fork.
And because the physical fire lacks inherent independent existence, because it is empty, according to Shunyata, it has no choice but to conform to that higher frequency of truth.
Exactly. The physical elements are dependently arisen. They are fluid, not fixed.
Therefore, when they encounter the profound, unshakable truth of a bodhisattva's pure intention, the elemental reality of that moment is forced to reconfigure.
The fire retreats because the truth spoken by the chick carries a heavier, more fundamental reality than the heat of the flames.
The Buddha continues his approach to Shugupta's house, and incredibly, a second lay devotee stops him with the exact same frantic warning.
The physical tension is really building, but the Buddha remains completely undisturbed.
He offers a second Jataka tale to further illuminate the nature of his invulnerability. This story takes place during a devastating drought in a once verdant forest.
The Buddha reveals he was incarnated as a hare. But a hare with the capacity for human speech and deep philosophical insight.
He had befriended an ascetic sage who lived in the forest.
This is one of the most beloved stories in the canon, the tale of the hare and the sage. The drought is so severe that the forest is dying.
There are no roots, no fruits, no leaves. The ascetic sage is starving and realizes he must abandon his practice in the forest and return to the city to survive.
The hare, driven by immense compassion, cannot bear to see his friend's spiritual practice broken by physical hunger.
He begs the sage to stay for just one more day, promising to find food.
The hare scours the barren forest, exhausting himself, but finds absolutely nothing. The drought has taken everything.
So he returns to the sage. The sage has lit a fire to perform a ritual, preparing for his departure.
The hare approaches the fire and makes a radical, unthinkable decision. He announces to the sage that he has found a meal, and that meal is his own flesh.
The sage is horrified, naturally, trying to prevent it, but the hare proceeds to make an act of truth.
And the specific wording of the hare's vow is perhaps the most important detail in the entire story.
The wording dictates the entire karmic trajectory of the act, doesn't it?
It does. The hare stands before the fire, calls upon the gods and spirits of the forest to witness his mind, and declares his motivation.
He explicitly states what he is not seeking.
Yes. He says, "I do this not to be a king, nor for the sake of wealth or a higher rebirth. I do this not to attain the rank of Shukra or Brahma."
He is actively rejecting any transactional worldly reward. His sacrifice is not an investment for future pleasure.
He strips away all self-interest. He then states his true aim. Rather, "I do this in order to attain supreme and perfect awakening and reach perfect Buddhahood."
So that I may tame those beings who are not yet tamed, liberate those not yet liberated.
This is the absolute distillation of bodhicitta. He is offering his body solely to achieve the capacity to save others.
He hurls himself into the blazing fire pit, but the fire does not consume him.
Instantly, the flames die out, and the pit transforms into a magnificent cool pool of lotuses.
The hare is found sitting unharmed upon a 1,000-petaled lotus, buzzing with bees, offering Dharma teachings to the overjoyed sage.
The Buddha then reveals that the ascetic was actually a past incarnation of his great disciple Kashyapa.
There's a subtle but profound escalation here from the story of the partridge chick. Well, the partridge chick used truth to make the fire retreat, averting disaster. But the hare uses the absolute purity of bodhicitta to actively transform the destructive element into an object of sublime beauty.
Ah, yes. The fire doesn't just stop. It becomes a lotus pool.
Exactly.
That is the alchemy of the bodhisattva path. A realized being doesn't merely survive samsara. They metabolize its suffering and transform it into the very environment of awakening.
And this principle perfectly sets up the climax we are about to witness in Rajago.
The narrative snaps back to the present moment, mirroring the past life story perfectly.
The Buddha finally arrives at Shrigupta's main gate. A massive crowd from the city has followed the procession.
They're holding their breath, vibrating with tension because they know the trap is there.
They watch as the Buddha steps his golden-colored right foot directly onto the thin, deceptive cover of the fire pit.
The trap is sprung.
But the mechanism fails entirely. The moment his foot touches the trap, the deadly, flameless fire vanishes.
Just like in the story of the hare, the blazing pit is instantaneously replaced by a pristine pool of lotuses buzzing with bees.
The celestial beings shower him with flowers, and the terrified silence of the crowd erupts into joyous cheering.
The worldly logic of Janaputra's trap completely collapses because it meets a force entirely incompatible with its nature.
The fire requires the fuel of delusion to burn.
Right, and the Buddha offers only the cooling waters of profound emptiness and compassion. The transformation is inevitable.
The sheer volume of the cheering crowd reaches Shrigupta's wife, who is still locked inside the house.
Realizing the Buddha has survived the first trap, she breaks out of her confinement and runs to the courtyard.
She finds Shrigupta standing on the roof, staring down at the gate in absolute paralyzing terror.
He sees the lotus pool. He sees the Buddha standing unharmed upon it.
The text notes that his hair literally bristles with fear. The reality he constructed has just completely shattered.
He races down from the roof, throws himself at the Buddha's feet, and begins to confess.
He says, "I was a deluded fool under the influence of a non-virtuous friend." He begs for forgiveness.
Let's look closely at how the Buddha receives this confession, because it really challenges our conventional notions of justice.
It truly does. As a modern reader, the speed of the Buddha's forgiveness is jarring.
Very jarring. We are talking about a man who, moments ago, was actively trying to execute the Buddha in a fire pit.
And yet, the Buddha accepts his confession instantly. He says, "Because you confessed and admitted it when you saw you were guilty, and commit not to do so from now on, I will accept you."
Stand up, householder. You have now honored me.
There is no demand for penance. There is no probationary period. Why doesn't the Buddha require Shrigupta to suffer for his crime?
It's a fundamental question. How does this Buddhist view of confession differ from our modern, often highly punitive, ideas of crime and punishment?
Right, because usually we want to see the person pay.
It is a radical departure from punitive justice, and it requires us to understand the deep psychology of Buddhist confession.
Okay, let's explore that.
In many worldly systems, confession is about appeasing a wrathful judge, admitting guilt to a higher authority, and then paying a debt to society through suffering.
The focus is heavily on retribution.
Yes, but in the Dharma, confession is a functional mechanism for clearing karmic obscurations.
So it's not about punishment at all?
Not at all. When Shrigupta was plotting the murder, his mind was completely opaque, clouded by dense delusion and the toxic influence of his Jain teacher.
He was living in a distorted reality. He believed his own lies.
The moment he looks down from the roof and sees the lotus pool, that delusion forcefully cracks. The shock shatters his certainty.
And when he throws himself at the Buddha's feet and verbalizes his error, when he genuinely confesses, he is voluntarily letting go of that toxic mental framework.
The Buddha has no need for Shrigupta to suffer. A Buddha takes no joy in retribution. The Buddha's only goal is for Shrigupta to see reality clearly.
By accepting the confession immediately and without condition, the Buddha seals the clearing of that obscuration.
He validates Shrigupta's return to reality. The immediate blinding hatred has been scrubbed away, making his mind finally capable of receiving actual teachings.
I think everyone listening can relate to that feeling on a smaller scale. Think about the last time you're in a heated argument, completely convinced you were right.
We've all been there.
And then you suddenly realized you were entirely embarrassingly wrong. There's a painful, humiliating moment where your ego shatters.
Yes, very painful.
But if the person you are arguing with meets your apology with immediate grace instead of punishment, the relief is profound. It changes the entire dynamic of the relationship.
It creates a space for genuine transformation rather than just fearful compliance.
But Shrigupta's relief is short-lived because surviving the fire is only half the battle.
That's right. The first trap is neutralized, but the second trap is already inside the house.
Shrigupta realizes the Buddha is about to walk in and eat the feast that Shrigupta himself laced with deadly poison.
He drops to his knees again, terrified for a completely different reason now, and begs the Buddha not to eat the food, confessing the second half of the assassination plot.
Once again, the Buddha meets panic with absolute tranquility.
He reassures the trembling householder, stating, "Poison could not physically affect me, even when I was born as an animal. How much less so now that I am a completely awakened Buddha?"
There is no basis for poison to physically affect me.
And to illuminate this mechanism, he shares the third Jataka tale, the story of the peacock king Suvajavasa.
This story is incredibly rich with imagery. The setting is the ancient city of Varosi, ruled by King Brahmadatta.
The Buddha later reveals this king was a past incarnation of his foremost disciple, Shuriputra.
The king is married to Queen Anupama. Far away from the city, residing on the southern slope of the snowy king of mountains, lives the peacock king.
The text describes him as breathtakingly beautiful. His body is brightly colored, his beak is adorned with jewels, and his call is incredibly resonant and sweet.
One evening, the peacock king cries out from the mountains, and the sound carries all the way to Varasi.
Queen Anupama hears it and becomes completely obsessed. She tells King Brahmadatta, "If I cannot see this bird, I will die."
Driven by his wife's obsession, the king dispatches his best hunters to the mountains to trap the magnificent bird.
The hunters lay out their nets and snares, working tirelessly for 7 days, but they encounter an impossible phenomenon.
Every time the peacock king merely looks at their nets, the ropes tear.
When he glances at their traps, the mechanisms spring open harmlessly. He cannot be captured by force.
Eventually, the peacock pities the exhausted, frustrated hunters. He approaches them and explains, "You cannot catch me with traps."
He says, "If the king wishes to see me, he must sweep the city clean, scatter flowers, raise banners, and come himself with a jeweled chariot to invite me."
This specific detail is crucial for our understanding of spiritual practice, isn't it?
It is. The peacock king represents a highly realized being, an embodiment of the Dharma. The hunters represent worldly ambition, trying to capture spiritual insight through force and grasping.
The teaching here is that profound spiritual realization cannot be coerced, trapped, or forced. It must be approached with reverence.
The king must create an appropriate, purified physical and mental environment to invite the teaching in.
When the king humbles himself, purifies his city, and offers a respectful invitation, the peacock king willingly travels to Varasasi, where he is treated with immense honor and reverence.
The king is so devoted that he feeds the peacock himself. But as time passes, the king's attention is pulled away by royal duties.
And he delegates the task of feeding the revered bird to Queen Anupama. This is where the plot turns dark.
Very dark. Queen Anupama harbors a dangerous secret. She has developed an attraction to another man and is carrying on an illicit affair.
One day, she realizes that the Peacock King possesses the ability to speak and understand the human language.
Panic sets in. She is terrified that the bird will reveal her infidelity to the king, which would lead to her execution.
To protect her secret, she decides to silence the bird permanently by heavily lacing his daily food and drink with deadly poison.
And this brings us to one of the most astonishing visual metaphors in the entire Esoötra. We must pay close attention to what happens when the Peacock King consumes the venom.
The text describes the result explicitly. No matter how much poison food and drink she gave to him, his body became that much finer, more beautiful, more attractive, and more radiant.
The poison doesn't make him sick. It literally nourishes him. It makes his feathers glow brighter.
When I read this passage, it immediately brought to mind the advanced practices found in Tibetan Buddhism.
Oh, absolutely.
Specifically, the mind training practices known as Lo Jurong and the alchemical methodologies of Tuh Entra.
That is a perfect parallel. In those traditions, practitioners are not taught to run away from the poison of negative emotions, difficult people, or severe adversity.
Instead, they are taught to take those very poisons and metabolize them. They use the energy of the affliction as the actual fuel for their spiritual growth.
It highlights a significant progression in the Mahayana path. When a practitioner is just beginning, they're often advised to avoid poisons entirely.
Right. They practice strict renunciation, avoiding toxic environments and triggering situations because their minds are vulnerable.
But a highly realized bodhisattva, symbolized by the Peacock King, engages in internal alchemy.
Because the Buddha's mind is completely free of the toxic clinging of samsara, because he has no ego receptors for the poison to bind to external toxins cannot cause corruption.
They pass through the system, but not without effect.
Exactly. The Bodhisattva's profound realization of emptiness allows them to consume the negativity of the world and transform it into radiance.
The poison actively increases his splendor. He digests the malice of the queen, and outputs beauty.
This is the ultimate goal of Lojong practice, to reach a point where the hostility of others doesn't diminish your compassion, but actually strengthens your patience and deepens your resolve.
Queen Anupama is utterly baffled by his growing radiance. Eventually, the Peacock King speaks to her, revealing that he knows exactly what she's doing and why she is doing it.
He exposes her affair and her attempted murder. The shock, guilt, and terror are so overwhelming that the queen falls violently ill, dies, and descends into the hell realms.
The Buddha concludes the story by revealing he was the Peacock King, telling Kragupta, if poison couldn't harm me then, when I was an animal, it certainly cannot harm me now.
But the Buddha's compassion doesn't stop at demonstrating his own invulnerability. He is traveling with a retinue of monks who are not yet fully awakened.
We cannot safely eat the poison food.
So the Buddha provides Sragupta with a highly practical tool to neutralize the physical poison.
This marks a fascinating transition in the Esoötra. The Buddha moves from demonstrating his realization to bestowing an active practice.
He teaches Sragupta a specific liturgy, a series of verses of truth to recite over the poisoned feast.
These verses are incredibly powerful.
They really are, and I want to quote them directly because they offer a profound etiology of worldly harm.
Please do.
The Buddha instructs Sragupta to stand over the food and recite, attachment, anger, and delusion. These are the three worldly poisons. The blessed Buddha is without poison. The Buddha's truth conquers poison.
He repeats this formulation for the Dharma and the Skunga.
And then he reveals the underlying mechanism of toxicity. All the poisonous trees and all the poisonous animals arise from the poison of desire. Desire is the worst poison.
He repeats this, attributing worldly poisons to anger and delusion as well.
If we look closely at the mechanism here, the Buddha is tracing the physical hazards of the world all the way back to the root afflictions of the mind.
Yes. Poisonous trees, venomous snakes, toxic food, these are not presented as random accidents of a chaotic nature.
In Buddhist cosmology, they are the external karmic manifestations of the three root mental poisons, desire, anger, and delusion.
By verbally invoking the ultimate, undeniable purity of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, Sragupta is overriding the lower reality of the physical poison with the highest truth.
The physical manifestation of poison is rendered completely inert.
Following the instructions, Sragupta recites the verses three times. He then personally serves the meal to the monks with his own hands.
The food is consumed safely. The monks are satisfied. The physical threats have been entirely neutralized.
Now, the true work begins. Sragupta takes a low seat beside the Buddha to listen.
And here we witness the ultimate antidote, the opening of Shugupta's Dharma eye.
The pedagogy the Buddha employs in this moment is beautifully structured and deeply instructive.
He doesn't immediately overwhelm Shugupta with the most profound esoteric truths about emptiness, does he?
No, not at all. He meets Shugupta exactly where he is. The text notes that he taught him systematically.
He began by teaching about generosity, then moved to moral discipline.
He discussed the mechanics of higher rebirth, the inherent faults of worldly desire, and the profound benefits of renunciation.
It's a step-by-step approach, very similar to the Lam Rim, or the stages of the path, developed much later in Tibet.
Exactly. He is laying the foundation. He is ensuring Shugupta understands the basic laws of cause and effect, of karma and ethics, before moving on.
You can't grasp the emptiness of reality if you don't first understand how your actions impact others.
Precisely. The Buddha acts as a master physician, carefully monitoring the patient's vitals.
Only when he observes that Shugupta's mind has become joyful, flexible, virtuous, and unpolluted does he introduce the most sublime teachings.
The teachings regarding the Four Noble Truths and the ultimate nature of reality.
And the result of this careful preparation is immediate and profound. While still sitting on a seat listening to the discourse, Shugupta develops the dustless and unobscured Dharma eye.
He attains a direct realization of truth.
The Esutra provides us with a gorgeous metaphor to describe this transformation. It says, "Just as a piece of fabric that has carelessly become stained, but is fit to be dyed, will thoroughly absorb the color it is soaked in, so did the householder Shugupta develop the dustless and unobscured Dharma eye."
Let's sit with that image for a moment.
The fabric metaphor.
Yes. It implies something vital about human nature. It suggests that Shugupta's intense hostility and murderous intent were not his fundamental nature. They were merely adventitious stains on an otherwise fit fabric.
His underlying nature, his potential for awakening, was always present, just carelessly dirtied by his association with a bad spiritual friend.
But this raises a challenging question, doesn't it?
It does. If his fundamental nature was ready, why did Shugupta have to go through this incredibly extreme, violent act of attempted murder to finally become receptive to the Dharma?
Why couldn't he have just wandered up to Vulture Peak on a pleasant Tuesday afternoon and listened to a teaching like everyone else?
That brings us to the profound and sometimes difficult concept of karmic ripening and exhaustion.
Sometimes, an individual's ego, their pride, and their delusion are so densely packed and calcified that a gentle teaching simply cannot penetrate the armor.
They are locked securely in their own arrogance.
Shugupta was wealthy, comfortable, socially powerful, and entirely confident in his Jain master's logic. He literally believed he possessed the intellect to outsmart and murder an omniscient being.
He had to hit absolute rock bottom.
He had to exhaust that specific violent trajectory of his karma. He had to physically build the fire pit, set the elaborate trap, anticipate his victory, and then experience the absolute mind-shattering shock of watching his entire constructed reality be utterly dismantled.
Dismantled by the Buddha's effortless purity.
It was the exhaustion of his own negative karma, combined with the sheer awe induced by the lotus pool, that finally shattered his calcified ego.
Only when his cup was completely emptied of its toxic pride could it be filled with the pure color of the Dharma.
Shugupta immediately takes formal refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, committing his life as a devoted lay practitioner.
The monks sitting in the courtyard witnessing this are absolutely astounded. They are looking at a man who barely an hour ago was actively trying to burn them alive and poison their food.
And now they see a man who has attained a high state of spiritual realization.
It seems miraculous, sudden, and perhaps even deeply unfair.
But then the Buddha speaks up and reveals the final shocking twist of the Esutra.
He tells the astounded monks that this entire dynamic Shugupta trying to burn him alive and the Buddha intervening to save him from the hells is not happening for the first time.
This is where the Esutra pulls the camera back, expanding our view from a single afternoon in Rajagua to reveal a staggering multi-lifetime karmic tapestry.
The Buddha shares the fourth and final Jataka tale, the story of the Brahmin boy Dharmakama.
In this past life, long ago, the Buddha was incarnated as a pure, highly virtuous Brahmin boy named Dharmakama.
He was deeply devoted to seeking eloquent expressions of the Dharma. He was widely respected by the public, well supplied with resources, and possessed a handsome, radiant appearance.
But in his community, there was another Brahmin teacher who was intensely, bitterly jealous of Dharmakama's honor, wealth, and literary ability.
The Buddha reveals to the assembly that this jealous Brahmin was, in fact, a past incarnation of Shugupta.
the pattern of hostility repeats itself across time.
The jealous Brahmin approaches Dharmakama and claims to possess a profound verse of teaching, an eloquent expression of truth.
However, driven by pure spite, he refuses to share the verse unless Dharmakama agrees to perform a horrifying act of self-sacrifice.
The demand is grotesque. The jealous teacher demands that Dharmakama personally dig a deep pit, fill it with a flameless, smokeless fire, erect a tall sacrificial post beside it, and then hurl himself into the blazing flames.
He claims he will only speak the verse as Dharmakama falls to his death.
Dharmakama, remarkably, agrees to the terms. But his reasoning is not born of despair. It is driven by pure bodhicitta.
He declares, "All my efforts in seeking eloquent expressions have been dedicated to the benefit of beings."
He insists on hearing the verse before he jumps so that he can memorize it and share it with the gathered crowd. He wants the wisdom to survive him.
The ensuing dialogue between the two is striking. The jealous Brahmin recites a preliminary verse about giving up happiness to find manchis.
Dharmaka counters with a higher truth, reciting a verse about giving up worldly happiness to find ultimate awakening.
The massive crowd that has gathered begs Dharmakama not to go through with it. They see the malice of the teacher.
But Dharmakama is resolute. He has the fire pit dug, he climbs to the top of the sacrificial post, and the jealous Brahmin, perhaps thinking he has finally won, shares the true verse.
And the verse the Brahmin shares, despite being offered with malicious intent, is actually quite beautiful and structurally sound.
He recites, "Always take joy in generosity. Always practice perfect moral conduct. Always apply supreme diligence. With wisdom, attain the supreme and holy Dharma."
Dharmakama absorbs the teaching, recites it loudly to the weeping crowd, ensuring they have the knowledge.
Then, mirroring the action of the hare from the earlier story, he makes a profound act of truth.
He declares to the universe that he is giving his life not for worldly gain, not for fame, but solely to attain supreme awakening, to liberate all sentient beings.
With that vow, he hurls himself from the post into the fire.
And once again, the physical world yields to the overwhelming weight of absolute truth.
The raging fire pit instantly transforms into a cool pool of lotuses, and Dharmakama lands softly, sitting upon a lotus seat, calmly continuing to teach the astounded crowd.
But the fate of the jealous teacher provides a stark contrast.
The text describes a terrifying instantaneous consequence. The jealous Brahmin's entire body suddenly bursts into spontaneous flame.
He cries out in agony, "I am burning because of what I said," and falls directly into the great hells.
His own malice, his own toxic psychological state, literally combusts.
But what happens next is the absolute core of the Bodhisusti ideal. Dharmakama, sitting safely on his lotus, looks down into the hell realms.
He doesn't say, "Serves you right." He doesn't revel in the justice of the moment.
He looks at his abuser and says, "Master, do not be afraid. I will help you."
He utters another act of truth, leveraging the merit of his pursuit of awakening for all beings, and instantly pulls the jealous teacher out of the hell realms.
This moment requires our deepest reflection, as it challenges our fundamental assumptions about justice and consequence.
It really does. I have to push back here on behalf of anyone listening who believes in accountability and justice.
Of course.
Isn't it incredibly frustrating that the bad guy gets saved so easily? The jealous teacher maliciously forced a pure, devoted boy to jump into a fire pit.
Yes, and lifetimes later, Shrigupta meticulously planned the assassination of the Buddha.
And in both cases, the Buddha just saves them, forgives them instantly, and grants them profound spiritual realization. Doesn't this completely undermine the core Buddhist idea of karma having strict consequences? Where is the accountability?
That is a completely natural reaction. We are deeply conditioned by our cultures to desire retribution, to want to see the wicked punished proportionately.
But we must look very closely at what the Buddha is actually teaching here about the complex mechanics of karma.
To answer your question, we look at the concluding verses the Buddha speaks to the monks right after finishing this story.
He states unequivocally, "Past deeds, virtuous or wicked, are not fruitless. Their fruits ripen unfailingly."
Karma is inescapable. The jealous Brahmin literally caught fire from the heat of his own toxic mental state. His hatred ripened into physical flames.
It did fall into hell. The mechanism of consequence worked exactly as it is supposed to.
He experienced the immediate, terrifying fruit of his action. However, karma is not a rigid, deterministic destiny. It is a dynamic web of causes and conditions.
The immense compassion of a highly realized bodhisattva is a new, overwhelmingly powerful karmic force that can intervene in that trajectory.
The Buddha didn't erase the man's initial bad karma. He introduced an immense counterforce of merit and pure intention that pulled him out of the result.
And this reveals something deeply profound about our interpersonal relationships and the nature of samsara.
The connection between Dharmakamma and the jealous teacher, though born of intense hostility, abuse, and jealousy, became the karmic vehicle that tethered them together across lifetimes.
Because Dharmakamma generated pure, unadulterated compassion for his abuser in that exact moment of betrayal, he forged an unbreakable link.
That link allowed him, countless lifetimes later as Shakyamuni Buddha, to walk through the gates of Shugupta's house and finally shatter his delusion forever.
That is an astonishing perspective. The hostility itself became the thread of salvation. The very act of trying to destroy the bodhisattva ensured that the bodhisattva would never abandon him.
That realization brings us to the close of this incredible esotra. The entire retinue, the monks, nuns, gods, and spirits, rejoice and praise the words of the Blessed One.
If we are to summarize the main insights we've uncovered in our session today, we must start by recognizing that the physical protections against fire and poison detailed in this ancient text are not mere party tricks.
They are not magic spells or mythological flourishes. They are literal, narrative manifestations of ultimate internal purification.
The esotra is teaching us that true, unshakable safety in samsara comes from only one source, extinguishing the inner fires of attachment, anger, and delusion.
When the inner fires are out, when the ego receptors are removed, the outer fires have no fuel to burn. The poison has nowhere to latch on.
Precisely. Furthermore, we see the absolute infallibility of karma, beautifully combined with the boundless intervening power of bodhicitta.
The Buddha's omniscience allowed him to see past Shugupta's immediate, murderous intent to his ultimate potential for awakening.
This proves to us that no being is entirely beyond the reach of the Dharma, no matter how stained their fabric might currently appear to be.
And what does this mean for you listening to this today? It is very easy to listen to ancient stories of blazing fire pits, talking hares, and miraculous lotus pools and relegate them to a mythical past.
But we face our own poisons and fires every single day. We navigate incredibly toxic work environments.
We face the burning heat of our own sudden anger when someone betrays us, insults us, or even just cuts us off in traffic.
We ingest the slow, daily poison of jealousy, resentment, and anxiety.
The Dharma teaches us not to run frantically from these worldly fires. We shouldn't be like the partridge mother, desperately splashing tiny drops of water against an inferno of worldly stress.
Instead, we are called to transform them. We do this by recognizing their empty nature, their shunyata, and by maintaining an unshakable adherence to the truth of compassion.
When we meet hostility, not with defensiveness, but with the armor of patience and the alchemy of bodhicitta, the toxic environments cannot corrupt us.
Like the Peacock King, we can learn to metabolize the adversity of our daily lives into the very fuel that deepens our spiritual realization.
Which leads us to a final provocative thought to take with you into your practice this week. Think about the dynamic between Shugupta and Dharmakamma.
That multi-lifetime tether of hostility and salvation. The esotra strongly suggests that our greatest antagonists, the people who seemingly spend their lives setting fire pits in our paths, the people who constantly undermine us, might actually be deeply intertwined with our own karmic history.
We so often pray for the difficult people in our lives to just disappear.
Yeah.
It is our strongest worldly impulse to avoid them.
But consider the alternative. What if the people who trigger your most toxic poisons today are actually providing you the exact opportunity you need?
What if the person who drives you the most crazy, the one who hurts you the most, is the specific karmic catalyst required for you to finally let go of your ego and generate the lotus of your own awakening?
It changes everything when you stop seeing them merely as an obstacle and start seeing them as the vital condition for your practice. The next time someone sets a trap for you, consider what happens if you walk into it not with blind ignorance, but with absolute compassionate awareness. Thank you for joining us for this teaching. May it benefit your path,